Would you like to begin, comrade, and then we'll bring in Howard afterwards? If I could remind you, please, to I don't think I need to, but stay muted while the speaker is talking. Thank you very much. Off we go, Bill.
Thank you, comrade chair. Comrades, friends, thank you for coming along with us to our May Day celebration. So my question is, why are we celebrating? What? I think the simplest thing to say is because it's our day. A day that belongs to the people who work, the so-called key workers and non-key workers alike, whose labour wealth is generated and our society is kept running. But so what if it is our day? Why is that worth celebrating? Well, let's just pause a little and, as with good science, ask what seems an obvious question. What is a day? That may seem very straightforward, but I wouldn't have much of a talk for you if I couldn't pick it apart just a little. Of course, the answer that's springing to all your minds is that a day is the time it takes the Earth to complete one rotation around its axis relative to the Sun. Conventionally, we say that takes 24 hours. But of course, it does, in reality, vary a little due to the way the Earth spins. But it's only a matter of seconds. Of course, seconds add up. Apparently, the exact scientific definition of a day is 86,400 seconds. I could hit you with more detail, but you're just as capable of reading the Wikipedia entry for day as I am. So I'll leave it there. But my point is this. This is a relatively modern definition of day, one born of an industrialized mindset that measures everything and wants to standardize everything into neatly defined, infinitely reproducible and replaceable commodities. The idea of day was around long before that. As we experience it, a day is defined by sun or absence of sun, by those hours of daylight in which humans, certainly in pre-electric light days, could be active and safe in the world, as opposed to night, that time of danger and darkness from which we sheltered in our homes and by light of fires. Some of us experienced a little of this during the lockdowns. With the option of brightly lit pubs, restaurants or cinemas to go to an evening taken away, the short daylight hours confined many of us to our homes for much of the day, especially women. Whereas I could go for a walk in the evenings on relatively deserted streets, friends of mine reported being reluctant due to darkness and actual attacks in their areas. And of course, during those times of short daylight, my active hours of were entirely taken up by my hours of work. I worked during the daylight and could only go out in the darkness. And even my mobility was restricted in a certain way because I had to behave in such a way as to not appear to be a creepy attacker on those dark, relatively deserted streets. So the absence of daylight was a constraint on all of our lives. So a day is something other than an arbitrary measure of time or some objective aspect of a spinning rock in space. It's a unit of activity. We have evolved uniquely on that rock with its spin and alternating passages of light and dark. And in our bodies, we feel the effects of that evolution. We sleep in the night. We give up about 8 hours a day if we're lucky to that sleep. Days are something hardwired into our bodies, and if we don't sleep, we feel the worse for it. It's been recently reported there was a scientific experiment in France. A group of people were sequestered in a cave without communication devices, clocks, or other pieces of modern paraphernalia, but with electricity, light, and cooking equipment. They were there for 40 days with no means of telling the time, and they were asked to perform simple tasks like to prepare a presentation in 3 days' time. This was an experiment in isolation and bodily time sense. It'll be interesting to hear the actual results. It's interesting that people are looking at what happens when we are separated from the daylight cycle. There are obvious implications for space travel and colonization, because removed from Earth, we lose the obvious thing that mark days. It's interesting and telling that this experiment looked at how people functioned without knowing day or night. To get to the meat of this chat, a day is the fundamental unit of human activity. Our days are defined what we can do by what we do and what we can do. And that is also limited by days. To be able to go on performing tasks efficiently and well, we need to break them up into days and nights with time to sleep, refresh and rest between. To put this in basic form, the rough life expectancy of a person in Britain will be about 28,800 days. I won't give you that in seconds because we don't live life in seconds. Those 28,000 days are the only ones we will ever have. We never get refunds, we never get do-overs. At best, we can increase our allotment of days with a bit of help from medical science. For someone who works full-time, assuming a full career from 18 to 65, working 5 days a week, they will give over 12,220 of those days to their employers. That's 12,000 out of 28,000. And okay, that's just the raw level of abstract days. Of course, not every day is given of those days actually given over, but usually the best hours are the active, alert, able to perform hours. 8 hours of those days is given over to sleep, preparing for another day of work. Another couple of hours of each day spent travelling to and from work, leaving the rest for eating, relaxing, or meeting up with friends and family. But all the other activities are conditioned by being able to turn up to work the next day. So now we get to the idea of the class struggle. When we give over our time to our employer, we give it to them to achieve the ends they desire. In a capitalist society, that means producing commodities, goods and services, which they can sell with a view to making a profit. The longer we work for them, the more they can use us. The more we do for them, the more goods and services they can sell for more profit. Thus, they will want as many days from us as they can get. But here's the thing, the struggle isn't just over days as such in the abstract. It's about the very definition of a day, what amounts to a day's work. The number of hours we spend working for them increases how much they can get us to do for them. The fewer hours we work for them, the more time we have for ourselves, for our family, friends and communities. And it's not just about the length of the day. It can be about the intensity. Working harder during the hours we give also increases the amount of work and profit we produce for the day buyers. The harder we work, the less we can do in our own time. It becomes more a time for recovery to return to work. Employment contracts are written in the language of abstracted absolute hours. But the reality is what we are capable of doing or being made to do in any day that defines what happens to us and our employers. So it's not just you will work for 12 hours. You will work for 12 hours doing a particular kind of work. And of course, if they can get us to work harder and harder and faster within those 12 hours, that is as good to them as if they made us work 13 hours instead. Just look, for instance, at the recent struggle over unionizing Amazon warehouse workers. The accusation was they were worked to such a strict regime that the staff there had to micturate into bottles because they weren't allowed adequate comfort breaks. The intensity of the class struggle is played out in the bodily functions of the workers, not just, you know, passing water, but also the need to sleep and the need to rest and the need to eat. Amazon leads the way in the scientific study of efficiency, making sure that every ounce of effort they obtain from their employees is usefully turned to their profit, making sure that not a second of the day is wasted. The class struggle between the people who sell their days and the people who buy them is a struggle that defines what happens the very time we have on Earth. No amount of rock spinning gets to define that. Just as an aside, I was reading the other night about a conference of Islamic scholars that was called to discuss religious observance in space because a Malaysian man was about to go and be a pilot on an astronaut on the International Space Station. How can a Muslim pray five times a day when they're no longer connected to the spinning rock to mark the passage of time? Of course, they came up with a convoluted set of rules to make Muslims in space possible. But I think this helps illustrate my point. Days are not the property of the world. They are something that centres on humans and human activity that we create. Now, let's make this a little more concrete. There are roughly 31 million people who are in employment in the United Kingdom. Not all of these people are full-time. For instance, there are 3 million people who are underemployed and would like more hours. That might seem strange given that our society makes selling your days a condition. Of getting access to the goods and services you need to live, and we have to buy from the people who are buying all the days, that means that people not just want to, but need to sell their days in order to live. To put that in some other perspective, about 9 million would like to work fewer hours, but preferably with the same pay. That, I suppose, is the very definition of the class struggle there and then. But let's go back to that 31 million. Each of them will sell about 12,000 days of their lives to an employer. 31 million multiplied by 12,000 leads to a number with more zeros than it's worth the breath to say. Do the sums yourselves if you want to use a portion of your life on such a thing. Think about what could be done with that number of days. Our ancestors built marvels like Stonehenge with nothing more than deer antlers and lots of days of work. The benefit of those days' labour goes not to us, but to the owners of the world. But they need us. Without our days of effort, nothing would get done. but the rewards of all that hard work goes to them, not to us. And let's just be clear, this isn't about them underpaying us for those days or settling a fairer price for them. The very fact that we have to sell our lives means that the priorities, the decisions about what to make and what to do with our time, is taken away from us. And it's the priorities of the buyers that decides what goes on in the world. And just as another aside, the 31 million in employment doesn't encompass the whole of the working class. Their relatives who depend on the sale of those days are just as caught up in this system of robbery. We are looking at the vast majority of society being enmeshed in this dispute over days and what to do with the days versus a vanishingly small minority who actually do all the owning. I made a conscious decision. I didn't want to go into, it's kind of an easy way to write these things, to just go, here's the history of May Day, you know, Chicago riots, anarchists, international workers movement, remember that sort of thing. And I didn't want to go into history of things like the dispute over Sunday trading laws, which was a huge flashpoint in the Chartist movement in the 19th century, because the capitalist class had the bright idea of banning trading on Sundays, which was the only day that workers could actually go shopping because they worked 6 days a week. These things are part of our history and how we came to be where we are, but they don't define why we celebrate May Day. They're good to know and they're worth knowing, but for today's purposes, I'm not talking about them. So what I come to is we celebrate May Day because it's our day. We've decided it's our day. One of roughly 80 we will each get in our lives, unless there's a revolution and we change the situation. And it's a reminder that our days rightfully belong to us and that all the other days in the year belong to our employers, directly or indirectly. It's thus a promise to do something about that situation. If we are remembering that our days don't belong to us, we are remembering that they could belong to us. May Day itself is something of a shadow of its former glory, where once the trade unions could bring proud processions of tens of thousands to the street, nowadays it's a handful of weirdos who like to chant the name of Enver Hoxha. Of course, those glorious May Days were not all about May Day itself, or even about abolition of the wages system. But the mighty labour movement basking in its own glory, bigging up those unions and their status in society. But May Day was never about the unions. It's about the workers. The unions may have faded, but the workers are still here and still selling our days of our lives to the people who own the world. But we can't turn May Day into a wake. It's not a time for mourning. It coincides with the spring, the spinning rock's northern hemisphere tilting closer towards the sun. It's a time for new life and new growth, of change. Put it another way, it's a time of promise, and that's why we celebrate May Day. To make a promise to remember that our days don't belong to us and that they could, and to remember that the capacity for change is in our hands. Sorry if that's a little bit of a short piece, but I just wanted to make a simple point and move on to Howard's talk. So I hope you've enjoyed that, and I look forward to the discussion afterwards. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Bill, and thank you very much for battling against your cough and cold. I'll invite Comrade Moss to speak now. Thank you.
Thanks, Bill. Welcome to the second part of the May Day rally. What I've got to say will take a little bit longer than Bill, but not much. Okay. So we've heard from Bill what a day has meant in the history of humanity, and above all, what a day consists of in the moment of human history we're currently at. That moment, of course, is called capitalism, a time when people are constrained to spend a good part of their waking day working for an employer for a wage in order to live, whether that's decently, half decently, or otherwise. Now, I use the word constrained advisedly, because for most of us, our work in the form it exists is not what we choose to do if we didn't need to get money to live and to provide for ourselves and our families. That is not to say we wouldn't choose to work as such. In fact, we would, because work is an important human need. But we wouldn't choose to do it for an employer in a job under conditions of take it or leave it. we would choose to do work we genuinely wanted to do under reasonable conditions and without the gun of material insecurity to our head. So under a different social system and capitalism, we'd do a day's work that was meaningful to us, that suited us, and also suited and supported the collective social effort to produce and distribute goods for human need rather than for profit. Now, I mentioned profit, and that's the trouble with the society we live in, whether it's in this country, in the rest of Europe, in the USA, in Russia, in China, in Cuba, in India, in Africa, everywhere in the world. What underlies, what generates the production of and distribution of goods and services is profit. It's no profit, no production. And that's what ties us down to the kind of working day that we've not chosen and that most of us wouldn't do if we were free to choose. Who, to take a small example, and one a little bit close to home for me, who would choose to do the job a man does at a supermarket I go to shopping, which consists of sitting, looking at a screen at the entrance to the store all day and checking to see if anyone is stealing or looks as though they're stealing? I think it's fair to say that the answer is no one would freely choose to do that. Yet we can be sure that if such a job were advertised, the wolf from the door imperative would mean that there'd be many applicants. I'll give another example, which says even more, I think, about the way society is organized and its priorities. A TV program I watched recently gave a striking example, not only of workers having to take the work available to them, but of the grotesque nature of the way in which this society expends human energies and resources. The program was about the efforts gone to catch people who use the London transport system without paying their fare, or at least without paying their full fare. A huge network of computers and other machinery filling a whole building has been set up, employing large numbers of people to catch out the offenders and present them for punishment. One of the program's focuses was on two of the employees at the sharp end, so to speak. It's their job to approach suspected offenders, especially those who found a way of underpaying their fare on the underground and have been identified on the computer and camera system. As the suspects exit their train or station, it's the job of the employees, who are obviously very apprehensive themselves, sometimes they've been waiting around for several hours, it's their job to pounce and to try and stop or apprehend the suspected offenders. Now, you can probably imagine some of the scenes, some of the encounters. Who would want to do that job if they didn't have to? And the waste of energies and resources in the whole thing are pretty mind-boggling. And this seemed to me a microcosm in that throughout the system as a whole, it's the kind of thing that's repeated many millions of times over across the whole planet. In my own line of work, for example, there's an ongoing dispute over the employees' pension scheme. I won't go into details, but on the one side, the scheme trustees and the employers are seeking to downgrade pensions. And on the other side, the employees and their trade union are desperately trying to resist that. The time and the energies, both physical and intellectual, going into this battle just beggars belief. And of course, it's a battle over money. But this is entirely typical. And indeed, it's an inevitable function of the waste of talents, energies, and resources that the market and the profit system generate. In fact, the destructive waste of all kinds generated by this system is so vast and complex that were anyone to attempt to measure it precisely, they'd be doomed to failure. Now, knowing that Bill was going to talk about a day's work in capitalism, I considered talking about a typical day's work in socialism. By that, I mean, by socialism, of course, I mean the moneyless, wageless society of free access and voluntary cooperation, that the Socialist Party has been advocating consistently for well over 100 years, and that, of course, hasn't yet come into being. I say I considered talking about that because when I began to think about it seriously, I realized that anything I had to say would be largely speculation. Not that speculation is necessarily bad in itself, but how helpful is speculation in the kind of detail that would be needed to describe a whole day of activity in a quite different kind of society? Other people have tried it, of course. William Morris, for example, to a certain extent in the late 19th century, in his brilliant novel News from Nowhere. But history soon made a lot of that look quaint. The same kind of thing would be the case if, far more recently than that, say just 50 years ago, someone had imagined a typical socialist day, what a typical socialist day would be like in the future. Then they would have been doing that before the age of modern electronic communication, for example. So a lot of it would be sure to seem obsolete now. And in this connection, a short time ago, I was looking at the pamphlet the Socialist Party published in 2006, entitled How We Live and How We Could Live, From Capitalism to Socialism. So 2006, not that long ago then. A great pamphlet, by the way, strongly recommend it. It's available to read on the party's website if people haven't actually read it. But in the chapter entitled Socialism as We See It, there's a long list of the kinds of products and occupations associated with money that wouldn't be necessary in socialism, around 150 of them. Now, a good many of these actually already seem old-fashioned today, less than 20 years later. Why? Because socialism has evolved quickly with the changes and particularly the technology it incessantly brings into being. So words from that list, which are now all but obsolete because the functions and activities they describe are no longer common, are, for example, football coupons, check cards, telephone meters, overtime payments, pension books, travellers' checks, Christmas clubs, luncheon voucher schemes, rent collectors. Some of them actually sound quite amusing now. And that's to name just a few. Of course, many of the products and tasks listed still do exist, but who knows how many of them will in, say, 10 or 20 years' time, and how many others we've not yet heard of will have come into being by then. In the same kind of connection, famously, Marx, when challenged by a contemporary critic for failing when talking about a future socialist society, for failing to explain in detail what that society would be like, readily owned up to that failure, a failure to write what he called recipes for the cookshops of the future. And history has shown that how wise Marx was to refuse to do that. Having said all this, I noticed that someone will be having a bit of a go at doing this in one of next month's talks. I would strongly recommend that people attend. It's called Daily Life in Socialism. Okay, I'd be very interested to hear about that. And I know we all will. Good. You know, it's definitely worth having a go. But anyway, what we can be sure of is that for as long as capitalist society continues, there will be an increasing number of products and occupations associated with money, far more than the 150 listed in that pamphlet. And some of them, no doubt, unimaginable at this moment in time. What's also sure is that for as long as capitalism continues, worker will continue to compete with worker for jobs. Business will compete with business for sales and profits. Nation will compete with nation over sales of goods and services, spheres of economic and political interest, control of trade routes and sources of raw materials. What's also sure is that the environment will continue to be despoiled instead of conserved. And in all this, the individual worker will see him or herself as a passive spectator, swept along by economic forces over which he or she has no direct control. So to go back to A Day in the Life, while we can't give a detailed picture of what a day will be like in socialism, we can say that it will consist of people carrying out meaningful and personally and socially fulfilling tasks in which they realize their potential as human beings. And this will be part of the broader planned organization of a social system that the population as a whole will have decided to adopt in place of what exists at present. It will be, as one writer has put it, a new form of life that does not organize itself around wage work and monetary exchange. And the same writer goes on, a society in which everyone can go to the social storehouses and service centers to get what they need. But I mentioned planning, so how will all this be planned? Well, for some good ideas on this, I strongly recommend another of the party's pamphlets, Socialism as a Practical Alternative, also available on the website. It was written some time ago, but really there's very little in it that doesn't remain valid today. One of the things we read in that pamphlet is the following. We would divide up responsibilities while taking into account individual aptitudes and proclivities. Some tasks would need to be performed locally, but many could be planned on a regional or global scale using advanced computer technologies. But beware, for reasons I've already given, what we read here has to be considered as ideas rather than prescriptions. What is patently clear, however, is that human beings are doers. And when the colossal waste of energies and resources associated with capitalism's money system, with its banking, insurance and finance, and with its accompanying military apparatus, when the whole structure ceases to exist, those energies and resources will be released for all of us to involve ourselves in being doers in a truly meaningful way, and to fulfill our needs at all levels, to engage in what's been called useful labor. And by the way, at that moment, all the items on that list, the whole 150 of them, will be obsolete. This kind of world has been excellently outlined recently in a book, highly sympathetic to our aim, almost accidentally sympathetic, I would say, to our aim, called Automation and the Future of Work. This book refers to a world, and I'm quoting here, of fully capacitated individuals in which every single person can look forward to developing their interests and abilities with full social support. And I would add to that, also a world in which care of the environment and its conservation are seen as vital. Finally, as has been argued by many articles in the Socialist Standard over the years and by many books on the subject, and not necessarily by writers professing to be socialist, human beings are essentially a cooperative species. We enjoy reciprocating, working together, even under the constraints of a non-cooperative system like capitalism. And all these cooperative energies will flourish and allow us to flourish in the new society we bring into being. It's been said by another author, even in difficult situations, the desire for cooperation would appear to be nascent, and the evidence suggests that we are naturals at it, given the opportunity. And isn't that indisputably borne out by the actions and attitudes we've seen around us among so many people during the events of the last year or so? I'll end with some words from, of all people, Martin Luther King, someone who is not often associated with socialism, but who hit the nail on the head when he said, "Profit forces people to be more concerned with making a living the making a life. And only socialism, I would add, will allow all of us on a world scale to set about making that life. Thank you.